Hello, this is Doug Clark Jr., podcasting from Louisville, Kentucky, recording episode 6 of Working Class Spark on December 8th, 2018. Welcome to the 6th episode of Working Class Spark, where the news is for us, the workers, not for them, the rich and powerful. Thank you for listening to this episode, and let me begin by describing you what this podcast is for. This podcast is for sparking the working class. It serves as an ignition for workers' power against the rich and powerful who have their foots on our throats. It serves as a spark for street politics and collective action, and through these methods, we must fight for our freedoms and rights as human beings. This podcast is a rallying cry for you, the worker, the worker's advocate, and the desperately unemployed to stand up to the rich because workers have been screwed by the system. This is what this podcast is all about. All right, for the first piece of news this week, we're going to be going over the French protests that have been going on all week. We need to show solidarity with fellow workers all over the world. That's why we're covering this. I know a lot of people are saying, what's up with all these crazy French people, you know, burning up cars and smashing windows. But we need to show solidarity all over the world amongst workers because that's the only thing we're going to get done. And over in France, things are just a little bit more heated, and that's why they're behaving in the way that they are. So the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, and Orsay Museums, opera houses, and the Grand Palais Complex, along with other shops and restaurants on Paris's Champs-Élysées, will be closed this Saturday in fear of further Yellow Vest protests and actions. Across France, 89,000 police officers will be on duty and armored vehicles will be deployed. Paris saw some of the worst rioting in decades last Saturday when luxury department stores on Boulevard Haussmann were evacuated as cars were set on fire and windows smashed. Near the Louvre, metal grills were ripped down at the Tuileries Garden where fires were started. On the Place Vendôme, a hub of luxury jewelry shops and designer stores, rioters smashed windows and built barricades. Near the Arc de Triomphe, masked men burned barricades, set fire to buildings and smashed fences, and torched luxury cars on some of the most expensive streets of the city. And on the Arc de Triomphe, they sprayed graffiti that read, "Macron resignation, and we've chopped off heads for less than this." The demonstration spread on Monday to high school students, who blocked more than 100 schools to protest some of the government's education problems. The size of the crowds are estimated at 36,000 people on the streets on Saturday alone. The protests have taken place over a hike on taxes on both diesel and petrol fuel. So the government of President Emmanuel Macron announced on Tuesday that it would suspend the gasoline tax and planned increases in electricity prices this winter will be halted, and that a toughening of the rules for vehicle emission tests will also be scrapped. But Benjamin Cauchy, one of the spokesmen for the movement, said on BFM TV, a television news channel, this could have been done weeks ago and we would have avoided all these problems. But these protests have grown to reflect more widespread anger at the government. One protester is quoted saying, "This anger is rooted in a profound injustice, that of not being able to live decently from the fruits of one's work, not being able to provide for the needs of one's children," he added. "Working people need cars to get to jobs and conduct their daily lives, unlike many wealthier city dwellers who are unburdened by the gas tax increase and form much of the core of Mr. Macron's support. In places like these rural areas, a quiet fear gnaws at households. What happens when the money runs out around the 20th? What do I put in the refrigerator with nothing left in the account and the electricity bill to pay? Which meal should I skip today? How do I tell my wife again there is no going out this weekend?" There are a few prosperous cities where many residents strongly supported Mr. Macron in the 2017 election. On the other hand, there are other struggling rural areas and small towns of the post-industrial area that either voted for candidates on the extremes or did not vote at all. Middle-income earners would see a modest bump with current tax rates lined out for the 2018-2019 federal tax budget. Of the greatest beneficiaries would be those who are already wealthy in the top percent. The pattern is worse for retired people, almost all of whom will be worse off. The supposed purpose for these tax hikes, according to the Macron administration, is to increase more green policies. Quote, "The decision of the French Prime Minister shows the government has done things upside down and put the cart before the horse. The World Wildlife Fund's Pierre Canet told people gathered for the COP24 talk." Sorry about that. "The carbon tax must be accomplished by the process, a process that is market central and as inclusive as possible. Lorelei Limousin of Rousseau Action Climat, this is a failure that the government will have to learn from so they can put in place measures for a fair and more ambitious transition without delay," she said. So the protests are more than just about tax hikes. That's already been taken care of now. But people are still angry about the basic state of inequality in French society. And we have that same problem here in America. There's a lot of inequality here. There's the 1% and there's the 99% of us. So what we need to do is mobilize as a working class movement and fight for our rights as human beings. Right, for our second piece of news this week, we got an article from The Guardian. It's about the Sears layoffs, and it's entitled "Layoff Sears Workers Left with Nothing, and They Say Wealthy Bosses Are to Blame." And it's subtitled, "Thousands of Workers Have Been Fired and Outrage Has Been Directed at the Stewardship of Billionaire CEO Eddie Lampert." It's from Saturday, December 1st, and it was modified on Tuesday, December 4th. It begins with, "Andrea Patrick had worked at the Kmart in Rockford, Illinois for 9 years. In September, Patrick's store announced it would close as its owner, Sears Holding, struggled with falling sales and mounting debts. A month later, Sears, once the world's largest retailer and a part of America's cultural fabric for more than 100 years, filed for bankruptcy, putting thousands of workers' jobs at risk. Patrick said, "I'm a mother who has four biological children and one stepson, and my income is all we have. When you take away our only income, you leave us with nothing, and we don't deserve nothing. Mentally and physically, it drives on you. It's like saying you're not good enough, and we're all good enough." Sheila Brewer worked at the same Kmart in Rockford for 17 years as a full-time employee. 4 weeks into receiving severance pay, a bankruptcy court stopped the rest of the payments. In the meantime, Sears executives have petitioned to receive up to $25 million in bonuses. Brewer said, "It was a big toll emotionally and financially. It's a big slap in the face, them telling me that I can't get the rest of my severance because of bankruptcy. Yet they're petitioning in court to get bonuses for the executives when that money could go into a plan of some kind for full and part-time employees to receive some sort of package. It would help to pay bills to help get us back on our feet," end quote. Since their store closed, Patrick and Brewer have joined Rise Up Retail, a coalition of retail workers campaigning for better pay and conditions that has been gaining strength amid brutal layoffs for workers at Toys R Us and other retailers this year. Retail layoffs come even as the unemployment rate has fallen to its lowest level since 1969. Andrew Challenger, the vice president of outplacement firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas, said traditional retail had been the biggest cutter of jobs for 3 years in a row. More than 92,000 jobs have gone this year already, and more are coming. Sears plans to shutter 188 stores nationwide by the end of 2018. Retailers are hiring in big numbers, but for warehouse workers, logistics and tech jobs, and shopping moves, as shopping moves ever online, Challenger said. "But I don't want to minimize those losses. Many are in rural communities and impact people who don't have the skills retailers now want. Those jobs are never coming back." However, it's not just the internet that did it in for Sears. Its failure comes with its own particular issues. When Sears and Kmart merged in 2005, the company operated nearly 3,500 U.S. retail stores. By February this year, that number had fallen to just over 1,000. The merger was orchestrated by billionaire hedge fund manager Edward Lampert, who served as the CEO of Sears Holdings from 2013 to when the company filed for bankruptcy. Lampert's oversight of Sears Holdings since the merger of the Kmart has been criticized as the reason for Sears' bankruptcy and massive store closures. Rise Up Retail supported former Toys R Us employees in winning a $20 million severance fund for more than 30,000 workers who lost their jobs when the bankruptcy company shut down 800 stores. Carrie Gleason, the campaign manager of Rise Up Retail, said, "It's Eddie Lampert and his hedge fund that has destroyed Sears. This was a company that had many viable businesses, definitely parts that were struggling that need investment. Instead, Eddie Lampert lets the store be barren, stripped away the viable parts of the business, and let everything else run into the ground." As Sears CEO, chairman, banker, landlord, and transition partner, Lampert has managed to transfer many of Sears' assets to himself and sell off others. In 2015, he sold the real estate of more than 250 Sears retail stores and other company property to real estate investment fund Seritage Properties, which is 43.5% owned by Lampert's hedge fund. Sears has paid the fund an annual rent of $134 million, with 2% annual increases starting in 2017. As Lampert's hedge fund extended credit to Sears backed by at least 46 Sears properties, Lampert could receive the rights to those properties in the bankruptcy proceedings. In 2014, Lampert sold off Sears' profitable clothing company, Lands' End, to himself as the principal shareholder. In 2017, January 2017, Lampert finalized a deal to sell Sears Craftsman brand to Stanley Black & Decker for $900 million, which was used to pay off Sears creditors, Lampert included. As Lampard made efforts to transfer Sears' valuable assets to himself, the retailer suffered from a drastic lack of investment that hampered its ability to adapt to the changing retail economy. Workers blamed the cash drain for their plight. I could tell that this company was not led right. They just didn't seem to care about the employee," said Bob Bruins. He worked at Sears store in Cincinnati as a merchandising and backroom associate from 2010 to 2014. The store closed for good in April 2018. This was evident in their lack of investing in store infrastructure and not updating the technology. Lampard and his hedge fund, ESL Investments, have lent Sears around $2.66 billion, making Lampard the company's principal creditor who stands to profit from Sears' bankruptcy and final liquidation. In August, Lampard offered $400 million to purchase Sears' Kenmore appliance brand and an additional $70 million to $80 million for Sears' home services division. The dynamic right now is very similar to what happened at Toys R Us. There was a push for reorganization. There were viable business officers, but the creditors pushed for liquidation because they would make more money that way, added Gleason. Rise Up Retail supported former Toys R Us employees and winning a $20 million severance fund for more than 30,000 workers who lost their jobs when the bankruptcy company shut down 800 stores. We could save tens of thousands of jobs, but the creditors want to liquidate so they get paid. Currently, around 68,000 workers at Sears remain, but their future is uncertain after the holiday season, while several other workers are still grappling from recent store closures. I've been working at Kmart for 3 years, and it's been 3 years of my life I've put hard work and sacrifice into the store. It's been really depressing, said Naomi Castro, whose store in Los Angeles closed on 28th of November. She said that during the closure process, the store was consistently understaffed and ignored by management. As much as I like to look past it, Kmart was 30 years of my life that's always going to be there. Sears did not immediately respond to multiple requests for comment. All right, now third and final article for this episode is also one from The Guardian. And it sounds kind of humorous according to the title, but actually it gets into some serious issues. It's titled Amazon Robot Sets Off Bear Repellent, Putting 24 Workers in Hospital. And it's subtitled Accident in New Jersey Puts New Focus on Retailers' Warehouse Working Conditions. And it's from Thursday, December 6th. And it begins, 24 employees at an Amazon warehouse in New Jersey were taken to hospital after a robot accidentally punctured a can of bear repellent. A 255-gallon can containing concentrated capsaicin of compounding chili peppers was punctuated by an automatic machine after it fell off a shelf, according to local media. The incident happened on Wednesday at a warehouse in Robbinsville, New Jersey, on the outskirts of Trenton. Amazon said all of the impacted employees have been or are expected to be released from hospital within the next 24 hours. The safety of our employees is always top priority, and a full investigation is already underway. The employees were taken to hospital as a precaution, Amazon said earlier. The incident has again shone spotlights on conditions in Amazon's warehouse, which have been criticized in the U.S. and the U.K. for poor working practices and a focus on productivity over worker safety. A Guardian investigation in June detailed a multiple instance of workers left unable to work after injuries sustained in the warehouse, including the Robbinsville Fulfillment Center. Stuart Applebaum, the president of Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, said, Amazon's automated robots put humans in life-threatening danger. This is another outrageous example of the company putting profits over the health and safety of their workers, and we cannot stand for this. The richest company in the world cannot continue to be let off the hook for putting hard worker people's lives at risk. Bernie Sanders, the U.S. Senator who ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016, is among the politicians who have raised concerns about Amazon's work practice and low pay. In the U.K., ambulances were called to Amazon workers 600 times between 2015 and 2017. The company has denied that it had poor working conditions. All right, good job, Jeff Bezos. In closing, if you haven't gotten a sense of what is needed more than anything else here to produce a great podcast, it is that I need you to contribute. I need you to send me clippings of articles that you think would lend to the working class movement. I need book reviews and recommendations. I need to know the best working class freedom movement sites on the web. I need to be made aware of what is going on in your community toward helping the working class battle the parasitic rich. I need you to email me when what you're thinking or your opinions regarding our the show and the struggle. I need you to tell me in general what you, the listener, want out of this podcast. For this podcast to work, I need this to be a collective project amongst us listening working class members, advocates, and unemployed workers among us. I would also like to respond to some of your emails and share them with our fellow listeners. And if you have the Anchor app on your iPhone or Android, through the Anchor app you can actually leave a voice message that I would be able to play on the next podcast. I would also like to put together a segment with interviews. I could interview leaders, professionals, lecturers, and fellow workers who fight for the freedom of the working class. I would be interested in interviewing some of you, the listeners, who have something to say. So thank you for listening to Episode 6 of Working Class Spark, and I hope you subscribe. I'll be conducting each episode on the Saturday of each week from here on out, and we may feature the occasional special episode. Also, I know that I mentioned in an episode or two ago about getting interviews with some union reps. That is still in the works. I am waiting for some new recording equipment, and hopefully we'll be able to provide those interviews soon. Now, you can also find the show on all major podcast hosting sites across the web. If it's easier to find our podcast somewhere else other than through Anchor.fm or the Anchor app, you can just search for Working Class Spark over at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many others. And also, you can like our Facebook page over at Working Class Spark and hit the email button to reach us or email us at workingclassspark1@gmail.com. You can also now find Working Class Spark over at Instagram at Working Class Spark. I'll be updating these throughout the week also. There, I have images relating to working class solidarity and pics of some of our latest stories. But the only way to contact us and leave a voicemail message will be through the Anchor app. I look forward to getting your responses, and thank you, and let's keep sparking the working class. Hello, this is Doug Clark Jr. podcasting from Louisville, Kentucky, recording Episode 7 of Working Class Spark on December 15, 2018. Welcome to the 7th episode of Working Class Spark, where the news is for us, the workers, not for them, the rich and powerful. Thank you for listening to this episode, and let me begin by describing to you what this podcast is for. This podcast is for sparking the working class. It serves as an ignition for workers' power against the rich and powerful who have their foots on our throats. It serves as a spark for street politics and collective action. And through these methods, we must fight for our freedoms and rights as human beings. This podcast is a rallying cry for you, the worker, the worker's advocate, and the desperately unemployed to stand up to the rich because workers have been screwed by the system. This is what this podcast is all about. At this point in the episode, usually I like to do terms of the week, but this week I'd like to give a more of an explanation of exactly what angle that this podcast is coming from politically. As I've stated in the description of this podcast, Working Class Spark comes from a radical leftist point of view. Now, the forms that make up a radical or far left system of government are socialism, communism, and anarchism. Now, don't turn off after hearing that. I know what people think of when hearing of socialism or communism. They think Stalin, gulags, purges, mass starvation, but those are the result of authoritarianism rather than a radical leftist government. A true form of socialism, much less communism, has never been practiced in history. And what a true form of radical leftist system is about putting power in the hands of the workers. Workers should own the company they work for because they are the ones who are doing the labor. Right now, major stockholders on Wall Street own and control the factories and corporations, but they do nothing but sit and make the profits while we make crumbs. They don't unload trucks, sort freight, work a cash register, fill orders, or what have you for at least 40 hours a week. The fruits of our labor have been torn away from the rightful owners, that is us, the workers. Now, if a far-left system were to be won, the government would take power over or socialize the factories and corporations in the name of the people. And at some time in the future, they would be democratized for the workers. But I know what you're thinking right now. You're saying, how can a corrupt system like ours ever turn over the power to the workers? The answer is we smash the current approach, the so-called democratic system. It must go. Now, which form of a far-left government we construct in this place is for debate. And in all honesty, I'm not sure which one exactly it should be. But what I do know is right now socialism is the best form of government we have. And under socialism, you own your car, your house, all of your personal property, but the people own the big companies that serve our needs as equals. So in general, I believe the best practice for creating our new society is we must take the best ideas from socialism, communism, anarchism, and yes, our current capitalist democracy. And we must leave behind the gulags, purges, and mass starvation and collect the best ideas from the far left. So in conclusion, the view of this podcast comes from the socialist point of view. I take the best ideas of our four forms of government outlined above to build a fair system for the working class. And though it sounds extreme, our current democratic system must be smashed. Any ideas or thought would be very much appreciated on this topic. All right, for the first news article of the week, it's entitled The Gilets Jaunes. It's from the BBC and it's posted on December 14th. Please let me warn you beforehand that I'm going to murder the pronunciation of the French language here. I have absolutely no idea how to pronounce 90% of the French terms here, so please bear with me. On an ancient monument near Republic, fresh graffiti scars the old gray stone. Its garish scrawl, a slash of anger above the pigeon serenely scratching beneath the arch. Down with caviar, long live the cabal. A long shout in the breadcrumb trail of slogans marking the path of protesters through Paris last weekend. This boulevard of the French capital became, for a few hours of that day, an urban battlefield. Under vast posters showing their latest releases, lines of riot police and armored vehicles filed past the grand old Rex Cinema. In front of them, protesters pulled together barricades from street furniture as trees were set alight and tear gas filled the air. Franck, who wouldn't give his real name, was among the protesters on Saturday. A construction worker from the Calais region, he says that he supports the protest and came to Paris with four of his friends to join them. They were carrying gas masks and other protective gear. Franck was prepared for trouble. His friends, he says, were looking for it. By the time they arrived on the boulevard near Republic, they were part of a group of more than 100 people. They were overturning cars, breaking shop windows. They set fire to anything they could, he says. I'd never seen anything like it. Total chaos. It was war. Everything was on fire. Bins, cars, the protective hoarding around shops. The police charged us. The atmosphere was very tense. And the protesters, we all felt like we were in it together. French protests have often seemed like a dance between demonstrators and police. Direct action has a long and cherished history here. But these weekly confrontations between people and state are different. Not led by any union or political party, the Yellow Vest protests have unleashed the worst civil disorder Paris has seen for decades. Four people have been killed, many hundreds injured, and billions of euros of damage inflicted on the country's urban centers. The French government at one point warned of serious violence and fears for democracy and its institutions, with at least one protest spokesman calling for other people to march on the Élysée Palace, the home of the president. There is a difference between legitimate protests and unacceptable violence, the government has repeated time after time. And yet the power of this movement lies not in the violence at its margins, but in the quiet support of what polls suggest is more than half the country for its basic claims. President Emmanuel Macron came to power vowing to face down protesters and drive through long postponed economic reforms. For the first 18 months of his presidency, that's exactly what he did, forcing through changes in the labor law against the backdrop of noisy public protest and bulldozing past broad union-led demonstrations on railway reform. This current crisis erupted not over a flagship issue, but over a fiscal detail in the budget for next year, a routine rise in eco taxes on fuel. It wasn't even a policy that the current government had made. The commitment to annual tax rises on fuel, and especially diesel, in order to fund eco-friendly projects had been part of the previous government's legacy to Macron. But it was enough to spark a small local rebellion. A handful of motorists who started displaying their regulation high-vee jackets or gilets jaunes in the windscreens of their cars and posting their actions on Facebook. Now, a movement created on social media with no recognized leadership has forced President Macron into concessions that were unthinkable a few weeks ago. How? Because this is not a confrontation about fuel taxes or any one issue. It's about power. It's no accident that cars were the spark that ignited this anger. Not needing one has become the status symbol in France. Those in city centers have a wealth of public transport to choose from, but you need to be rich enough to live in the center of Paris or Marseille or Bordeaux, and most people are not. Economic growth happens in big globalized cities, but the working class is no longer live there, says Christophe Guillet, an independent researcher specializing in human geography. That's a major change. For the first time in history, they don't live where wealth and jobs are created. They live in a peripheral France, characterized by weak economic growth, high unemployment, and high anxiety. This economic model creates enormous wealth, he continues, but it creates it in a concentrated and unequal way. Since the 1980s, what we are seeing is a weakening of all categories of the middle class. Outside the ring roads that encircle Paris and other French cities, you will find the suburbs and satellite towns where workers like Mireille Benicia live, and the gap between the world she works in and the one she can't afford to live in is growing. She commutes into central Paris every day to work as a receptionist in a smart hotel just off the Champs-Élysées. After this month's violent protest in the capital, she says the hotel is empty and bookings have nosedived, but she has little sympathy for business owners here. To be honest, I still have the same salary, so what does it change for me if the business is not working or not? She says, I still have to go outside Paris to live and come into work every day. If the protests were more peaceful, maybe I'd join them. Without a car, those in France have been priced out of the big cities. Without a car, those in France who have been priced out of the big cities would struggle to get to work, take their children to school, and even to shop for groceries. Petrol prices here are roughly the same as in Germany or the UK, and French diesel prices generally lie somewhere in between its two neighbors. But there is a more general sense of unfairness, a feeling that the struggling middle class are being asked to shoulder more than their fair share of the burden, while France's millionaires have seen their top rate of tax slashed. And the pain was felt especially keenly this year because rises in the global oil price had already made fuel more expensive. In September this year, the government announced its planned increase in the eco-taxes levied on petrol, and particularly on diesel. Shortly afterwards, the first motorists began showing off their high V jackets in the windscreens of their cars, and Jacqueline Marod, a hypnotherapist from Brittany, published a video on social media that motorists were being hunted. Months earlier, Priscilla Ludowski, the manager of an online cosmetics company from just outside Paris, please excuse me, had launched a petition on the website change.org calling for petrol prices to be lowered. After the announcement on tax rises, it really began to take off, quickly gathering a million signatures. But still, she says, there's been no response from the government. We are not understood. We are not heard. Our opinions are not sought on big decisions, she explains. I get the impression that when the president speaks to people in the street, he's completely detached from reality. Then, in October, truck driver Eric Drouet, another initiator of the movement, suggested on Facebook the idea of a national blockage, calling on protesters around the city to block roads in their area on November 17th, obstructing and slowing traffic in order to get the government's attention. About 290,000 people took part. The Gilets Jaunes movement had begun. The movement started around the tax rise, said Christopher Gulli, but I think it's simply a pretext in the same way the Brexit is now fundamentally a confrontation with Europe, but first and foremost, a way for people to say, we exist. In France, people are using the Gilets Jaunes as a way to say, we exist, to the elites, to the political class, to those that have forgotten about them for the past 20 years, for the simple reason that they no longer live in the same place. The Christmas tree overlooks the motorway toll at Lake Cigote, 45 minutes drive outside Marseille, its tinsel and baubles catching the light from braziers flaring in the drizzle. The protesters here, as on the blockades across France, are settling into Christmas. Their tents are well stocked with food and drink from local well-wishers, and the noise from supporters honking their horns as they pass along the road frequently drowns out conversation. More than a dozen people stand around in their high V jackets, well wrapped up in hats and gloves against the cold. Many protest sites like this one have developed into semi-permanent camps, snaking along the roadside with plenty of cover for the elements and supplies of basic necessities stacked neatly on wooden pallets. Many are 24-hour operations, and more often than not, they are small rivalries and animated discussions over who should speak for the group. Antonin Olay is a retired technology teacher. He says social media has played a key role in creating this movement and restoring to people here a role in the national debate. The government wasn't aware of the power of social media and giving a voice to people who weren't being heard, he says. Beneath the ear-splitting blares of passing lorries, not only does it let people air their grievances, it also lets them communicate with people who feel the same way. These people don't often get to speak to the TV or newspapers. It's a way for them to mobilize, to show they exist. Some have questioned whether the movement was helped by a change to Facebook algorithms. Posts from companies and the media became less prominent, with individual contributions given a boost. But, as with other social media uprisings, the roots of this one runs deep. Guy says France is no longer just looking at an economic or social crisis, but a democratic one. You have here groups that have not been represented for a long time by the big political parties. Those who joined this movement are those that vote least, the most disengaged from public life. They wanted to have their voice heard, but they haven't had a way to do it. Olay thinks that politicians, union leaders, and representatives have all been discounted. People ask themselves, how can this person stand up for me if they don't know what my life is like? They are relocating everything from villages to big cities. There are fewer local schools, fewer local doctors or hospitals. One woman needed a helicopter ambulance to take her to hospital in time to give birth. It's no wonder people feel like they're being abandoned. The irony for Emmanuel Macron is that he came to power promising to rebuild trust in politics, especially among those struggling to thrive in the new globalized economy. This is the last chance, he told me on the campaign trail last year. If he was to fail, next time it would be Marine Le Pen. The reforms he promised were designed, he said, to create wealth and order that it could be shared with those who needed it most. It was a policy that aimed to liberalize and protect, but many here feel that the social protection for workers has fallen short compared with the liberal reforms enjoyed by businesses. President Macron pushed through the reforms where previous presidents had feared to tread, reducing the power of the unions in workplace relations, ending the special benefits enjoyed by the railway workers, and making it easy for companies to hire and fire staff. He also ended the wealth tax on all assets, apart from property, meaning a 70% cut in the tax for France's millionaires. It was meant to boost investment in the economy, but it was seen by many poor voters as further proof that this former banker-turned-president was still primarily a friend of business, not of the squeezed working class. France's Public Policy Institute recently published a review of who had gained and lost under Macron's presidency so far. It found that the buying power of the poorest in society had slightly shrunk, while those in the economic middle had slightly gained, but the biggest winners were the richest 1%. This sense of unfairness emerges time and again in the graffiti that has appeared on walls and monuments in Paris. Much of it calls for the resignation of Macron or simply the fall of the regime. On the Republic's famous monument at Republic, someone has changed the revolutionary right of universal suffrage to universal suffering. If the roots of protesters' frustration lie in the big economic shifts of the 1980s, how far did Macron himself encourage it to bloom into open opposition? In the last election, many people voted to change their situation, and they find themselves here, so they started to get frustrated, says protester Antine Olay. They've realized that those who govern them don't know what real life is like. For them, poverty is just a few set of numbers. Despite his warnings against populist nationalism, there have been times when President Macron seemed unaware of the tension swirling beneath the surface of French society, leading to criticism that he's aloof and out of touch. At a public event at the Élysée Palace earlier this week, he told 25-year-old Gardner, who complained of not finding work, that he would find a job easily if he applied to hotels, restaurants, or construction sites. "If I crossed the street, I'd find you one," the president told him, "so go ahead." After 4 weeks of national protest, he addressed the nation in a bid to satisfy demonstrators and drain the movement of momentum. What he offered was the most significant climb down of his presidency so far: a monthly bonus of 100 euros for those on the minimum wage, an end to tax and social changes on overtime and workers' annual bonuses, and a freeze in some pension charges. There was also an admission that he had sometimes got things wrong. "I know some of the things I've said have hurt you," he said, "but there was no formal apology and no change in the government's economic course. Further reforms planned for next year on pensions and unemployment insurance are still set to go ahead." Instead, the president's response was to look for solutions at the local level. He announced an unprecedented national debate on the environment, immigration, decentralization, and political disengagement. He also said he wanted to meet France's mayors region by region to build the basis of a new contract with the nation. The town hall at Le Pen-sur-Huet, 20 minutes drive from La Ciotat, is painted salmon pink. Three huge French flags fly from the poles above the entrance. Dangling from one of them is a high-beam motorist jacket, a gilet jaune. Christine Capdeville is the communist mayor of Le Pen-sur-Huet. When I ask her what she thinks of President Macron's solution to the crisis, she laughs. "President Macron has ignored us for the moment he came to power," she says, "and now, all of a sudden, he wants us to come to this rescue. He wants to come to his rescue. Wants us to come to his rescue." "Can I be honest with you?" she asks. "The idea of a national consultation is absolute rubbish. We're going to get a piece of paper asking for our grievances, and that's it. Then everything will carry on just like before." The call has gone out for another day of national protest. The fifth consecutive weekend for Gilets Jaunes, or Act 5 as it's being called. Franck is already planning to come back to Paris with his friends to see more of the action. The violence he saw last week near Republic will stay with him for the rest of his life, he says, but he liked the atmosphere. Everyone is getting together. We are all one, a very good team. It's not every day you see that. That sense of unity among the protesters is what has given the movement its energy and its power. Sylvie and Christophe arrived on the Champs-Élysées last Saturday at 9 a.m. I met them walking up the near-empty boulevard towards the Arc de Triomphe with a group of friends. She's far left, Christophe told me, and I'm far right, and we're here together for the Gilets Jaunes. That's what Macron doesn't like, he continued. We're united. He's brought back solidarity among the French. He's turned everyone against him. We're united in combat, at least for now. After that, who knows? Our strength is that we're apolitical, so he said. Maybe later, when there are new presidential elections, we'll put together a leaflet. But for the moment, we don't need a leader. That's our strength. Are you scared? There might be violence here today, I asked her. No, she replied. We have nothing left to lose. President Macron won last year's election by cannibalizing France's traditional center-right and center-left parties. It deepened splits within the remaining opposition and has helped keep the political opposition in check ever since. Now the divided opposition has been replaced by a social movement that has also united people from the left and right in the same way Macron did, along with many of those who are disillusioned with traditional politics altogether. Bruno Bonnell is an MP and founder member of the president's party, La République en Marche. He says the Gilets Jaunes could emerge as the new opposition to Macron. This movement looks like ours did originally, he said in the lobby of the National Assembly. I remember in Macharé when people were saying we had no program and we didn't know where we were going. We were debating in bars and cafes, trying to reinvent the world. This movement is more about resistance. It's populist like the Five Star Movement or Podemos. But if they gather more effectively with leaders and representatives, then we'll finally fix a clear opposition. He said he had visited protest site many times to ask specifically what demonstrators wanted, but that every proposal he made was rejected. We are now beyond that. It's a political conversation, not a conversation about money or compassion. Some protesters see a future as a political party, but so far diversity has been the movement's appeal, the right of each of its 10,000 members to speak, only for themselves. Distrust of representatives and is so strong that even the few spokespeople to emerge have come under heavy criticism, even death threats. But without a leader or a cohesive agenda, what future does this movement have? The leader ought to be the president of France, Anthony Joubert, one of the founders of the movement, said. It's he who has to understand us. He should be spending his time listening instead of creating a situation where restaurants can charge 15 euros for a bottle of water. As things stand, the Gilets Jaunes are leading ourselves. We are an assembly. We are a national assembly. Back at the barricade at Le Chiate, Anthony Ole has gravitated towards the makeshift barbecue as some of the protesters watch a few small piles of sardine crisp on the coals. There's talk about the next protest. Some in Ciate say they're planning to demonstrate here rather than make the trip up to Paris. Many have cautioned against dismissing the movement too quickly. Even if the level of protest and violence in the capital fails, the absence of a complete eruption last Saturday doesn't mean the protest is easy, cautioned the Daily Le Figaro earlier this week. The president won't win over the country by pulling out his checkbook or flaunting his intellect. He needs to open his heart. But we want a second revolution, Ole says. We want to show the rest of Europe that the people have some power. France was seen from the outside as having avoided a populist revolution 18 months ago. But the election of Emmanuel Macron simply papered over France's problems. Facing them will take a whole lot more. All right, that's from the BBC, December 14th. So since the first article was so long, I'm going to skip directly here to the end. In closing, if you haven't gotten a sense of what is needed more than anything else here to produce a great podcast, is that you need to contribute. I need you to send me clippings of articles that you think would link to the working class movement. I need book reviews and recommendations. I need to know the best working class freedom movement sites on the web. I need to be made aware of what is going on in your community toward helping the working class battle the parasitic rich. I need you to email me what you're thinking or your opinions are regarding the show and the struggle. I need you to tell me in general what you, the listener, want out of this podcast. for this podcast to work, I need this to be a collective project amongst us listening working class members, advocates, and the unemployed workers among us. I would like to also respond to some of your emails and share them with our fellow listeners. And if you have the Anchor app on your iPhone or Android, through the Anchor app, you can actually leave a voice message that I would be able to play on the next podcast. I would also like to put together a segment with interviews. I can interview leaders, professionals, lecturers, and fellow workers who fight for the freedom of the working class. I would be interested in interviewing some of you, the listeners, who have something to say. Thank you for listening to episode 5 of Working Class Park, and I hope you subscribe. I'll be conducting each episode on the Saturday of each week from here on out, and we may feature the occasional episode during the week. You can now also find the show on all the major podcast hosting sites across the web. If it's easier to find our podcast somewhere other than Anchor.fm or the Anchor app, you can just search for Working Class Park over at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other sites. You also can like our Facebook page over at Working Class Spark and hit the email button to reach us, or you can email us directly at workingclasspark1@gmail.com. But the only way to contact us and leave a voicemail message will be through the Anchor app. You can also now find Working Class Spark over at Instagram, also at Working Class Spark. I look forward to getting your responses. Thank you, and let's keep sparking the working class.